Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
The Florida legislature does its job as the 2016 session goes into the history books.
We had tough choices. This budget is not one of them.
Also tonight, a veteran Capitol Press Corps member gives his take on the 2016 session.
The most obvious, the most logical solution to any problem is to cut the baby in half and give somebody a little bit of what they want. Yeah, they zeroed this out. That's a humiliating defeat for Rick Scott.
We'll also find out what happened with a raft of final week legislation, and we'll look ahead to Florida's presidential primary next Tuesday. I'm Tom Flanagan. Happy Signy Die. It's the end of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Well, the Florida legislature's 60-day lawmaking session has come to an end. The House and Senate today voted out a budget worth just over $80 billion, and Nick Evans has the story.
Monday night, Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee and his House counterpart, Richard Corcoran, a Republican from Land O'Lakes, finished off this year's budget negotiations. But there are a couple of steps between that agreement and Friday's vote.
It takes staff at least 12 hours. So 9 plus 12, you're looking at 9 hours. I mean, clearly it'll be on the desk sometime during the day tomorrow.
With 160 members and a 400-plus page spending plan, 12 hours begins to make sense. The tome wound up on lawmakers' desks Tuesday at 2:53 in the afternoon. They can't take a vote on budgets for 72 hours. Lawmakers began discussing the plan Thursday on the House floor.
Members, the Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee overall proposed budget totals $34.3 billion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The education budget, members, provides the highest amount of state funds totaling $21.8 billion, which is an increase of $649.2 million.
Members, the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee's proposed budget is $4.98 billion.
Members, the Transportation and Economic Development Appropriations Conference Committee negotiated a $12.5 billion budget, which maintains both our...
...provided into this. I think we have a great environmentally sound budget to be able to present to you today. What I'd like to do is... Share, of course, top line, $3.9 billion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The government operations total budget is $1.97 billion, essentially the same as in the current year.
That was House Committee Chairs Matt Hudson, Eric Frezen, Larry Metz, Clay Ingram, Ben Albritton, and Jeanette Nunez, all Republicans, describing their specific silos within the budget. All told, the measure lays out $82.3 billion in spending. As the House began digging into the proposal, many GOP lawmakers had glowing reviews for the bill. Jacksonville Republican Representative Charles McBurney compares this year's budget to the ones when times weren't quite so good.
We had tough choices. This budget is not one of them. This is actually one that we can all get together on, which is something that we haven't been able to do since we started in that Great Recession.
And McBurney's right. Their support was tempered somewhat, but House Democrats voiced support for the budget as well. Here's Minority Leader Mark Pafford.
You know, the budget has improved, and today I'm going to support the budget. I'm going to vote for the budget, and I want to send a very clear message to the legislature in the other chamber and, frankly, the governor's mansion that the House has defined itself and, I think, done a good job.
And it seems clear sending a message to the governor is a bipartisan effort. Building support among Pafford's caucus is a warning. Be careful with the veto pen, because we have the support to override you. But there were quibbles, and one of the most forceful critiques came from Republican Representative Charles Van Zandt of Keystone Heights on the topic of public employee pay.
And I can tell you that for the past 3 years, I have struggled with some of our state employees that we underpay to the extent that their families qualify for welfare and food stamps. That's not right.
Friday, the Senate took up the budget, and again, there were some quibbles. Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala lamented the loss of economic development funding for the coming year.
It's the elephant in the room. It's probably the most disappointing aspect of this legislative session for me personally, and that is the governor's request for a $250 million enterprise fund program.
That initiative was a priority for Governor Rick Scott, along with a $1 billion tax cut package. Under the new spending plan, Scott gets neither. And lawmakers are already bracing for a vicious round of vetoes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Just a few hours before that final budget vote, we climbed five flights of stairs at the Capitol. The elevators were much too busy at the time to seek insight from one of the most experienced and astute observers of the Capitol scene. We are on the fifth floor of the Florida Capitol during this final day of session, the final scheduled day of session, we must add, and talking with Steve Busquet, who is Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald. A much different scene right now, Steve, than there was at this point in the session last year. I can't say at this time last year because, of course, it moved, and also the fact that that session went off the rails. This one has not.
That's correct. They're on their best behavior, Tom. Last year was an absolute train wreck, and, you know, you can't overlook an obvious fact. This is an election year. They want to avoid offending the folks back home to the fullest extent possible. This session is coming in for a smooth landing. There's still some very, very rough terrain ahead because there's a lot of talk about how much vetoing Rick Scott's going to do to the budget. I'm sure you want to talk about that. But this session, dramatically different than last year because they've more or less got their house in order here.
Okay, but how much of this conviviality, if you will, is forced and how much of it really is legitimate this year, do you think?
Oh, I think there's a little bit of both. I think there's some of both. There's been disagreements behind the scenes, especially and most notably on Rick Scott trying to get $250 million as a job incentive fund. And frankly, each side blamed the other. The House and the Senate blamed each other for how that went off the rails. And it shocked me as a person who's covered this place for almost 30 years. The most obvious, the most logical solution to any problem is to cut the baby in half and give somebody a little bit of what they want. They zeroed this out. That's a humiliating defeat for Rick Scott.
And that brings us to the question, as you intimated just a moment ago, that we're wondering what happens now with the governor's veto and what might be the tripwires for the legislative leadership to say, okay, that is a bridge too far. We're coming back to Tallahassee. We're going to override this.
Right. That hasn't been done since the days of Claude Kirk. That would be an extraordinarily dramatic change from the history of this state for the legislature to come back and override a large part of budget vetoes. Just to clarify, through the intervening years, we've had many cases where the legislature has overridden the governor's veto of a substantive piece of legislation or maybe a single budget item. But Rick Scott last year took a sledgehammer to the budget, and I think he's going to do it again. I'm reporting today that Senator Tom Lee, the Senate budget chairman, is predicting, guessing, at $500 million in vetoed projects. And in an election year, that is an incredible rebuke of the legislature. But the question they've got to answer, is it worth them coming up here and, A, humiliating the governor again for the purpose of putting what amounts to putting pork barrel spending back into the budget when they've got to face the voters in an election year in which the prevailing climate because of Donald Trump is sort of against establishment politics. There's a lot of dynamics moving around there. I'll believe it when I see it on overriding the vetoes.
Steve, a tiny bit of crystal balling here, and I'll let you get back to the action. Yeah. But next year, post-election, new leadership in the House and Senate. Any predictions how things might go?
Well, it's going to be a lot different because if I had the single most significant personality and politician in this current incoming group of leaders is, without a doubt, Representative Richard Corcoran from Pasco County. Really knows the process. Tenacious guy, not the kind of guy you want to be on the opposite side of. Now, Joe Negron, the new Senate president, is one of the few guys ever to chair the Budget Committee in both the House and Senate. Not many guys do that. He's seen as an extremely astute student, especially of the budget. And the other big difference is it's Rick Scott's last 2 years in office. And so people are looking over the horizon to the next governor's race, for sure.
A much more amicable situation in these final few hours of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session. Here on the fifth floor outside the Capitol Press Gallery, and one of its longtime denizens giving us his take on what's been going on and what's likely to happen next. Steve Busquet, Tallahassee Bureau Chief for Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. Thanks, Steve.
Tom, thank you.
Still to come on Capitol Report, while some religious leaders have supported the so-called Pastor Protection Act, others find it patronizing.
I don't need protection. I have the Bill of Rights, which protects me quite thoroughly. Thank you very much.
Lawmakers tackle the problem of too many dentists refusing Medicaid patients because the program pays far less than the standard fees for service.
We need to make sure that the reimbursement is required to be as high as it can through the statute, and we need to be giving them adequate fees to see these patients.
And the daughter of the leading Democratic candidate for president makes a Capital City stopover.
My mom has spoken a lot about fracking, and she says very clearly that when local communities oppose it, she opposes it. She thinks that this very much should be a locally determined question.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Florida Governor Rick Scott has signed a controversial bill dubbed the Pastor Protection Act. Regan McCarthy reports the measure would protect pastors and churches from lawsuits if they decline to participate in marriages that violate their beliefs.
Pastor Brant Copeland serves at the First Presbyterian Church in Tallahassee, and he's been one of the staunchest opponents of the conscientious objection measure.
Well, the Pastor Protection Act, so-called, is mislabeled as well. In my opinion, I don't need protection. I have the Bill of Rights, which protects me quite thoroughly. Thank you very much.
While some religious leaders have spoken in favor of the act, Copeland calls the legislation patronizing. He says he already has the right to decline to perform a marriage and has done so. He tells the story of one specific couple.
I thought that couple they just needed to mature a bit more. And with reluctance, I said, I really can't do the service. And a couple of days later, my phone rang in the middle of the night, and it turned out somebody had put an ad into Thrifty Nickel saying they had purebred puppies for sale, but be sure and call after midnight. I sort of suspect I was right about that particular couple and their immaturity, because my guess is they may have placed that ad.
But Copeland says in the 30 years he's been pastor of the First Presbyterian Church, he's never been sued for declining to perform a marriage ceremony. And Copeland says the thing that upsets him most about the Pastor Protection Act is the reason he thinks lawmakers brought it forward.
The more disturbing thing about this bill is it presumes that people in the LGBT community are somehow a threat to people of faith. And I think that's a very ugly thing to say about LGBT people. And that's the reason I oppose the bill.
And lawmakers haven't been too shy about that. Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean is one of the bill's sponsors.
On Friday, June 26, 2015, the United States Supreme Court in Obergefell versus Hodges declared a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. However, it did not address whether churches, religious organizations, related groups, or certain individuals may be forced or required to perform any marriage or provide services, accommodations, facilities, goods, or privileges for the related purpose if such action would violate a sincerely held religious belief.
Longwood Republican Representative Scott Plakin, who sponsored the bill in the House, says he started working on the legislation before the U.S. Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage across the country. But he admits that ruling does cause him concern. And members of the LGBT, or lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, say they find that offensive. But not only that, they worry the legislation could create a slippery slope.
There was a lot of really vague language in there about the types of faith-based organizations that were included under the bill.
That's Equality Florida Government Affairs Manager Carlos Guillermo Smith. He says lawmakers eventually passed an amendment clearing up some of the vague language, and his group, which advocates on behalf of LGBT people, removed its opposition. But he says that doesn't mean his group supports the legislation.
So while we've always said that the bill is unnecessary, it still is. We've always said that the bill is a bit insulting to the LGBT community. It still is. The amendments that have come forward at least clarify the extent to which the bill goes on the number of entities that are included. And it clarifies our questions so that we now know that the bill doesn't conflict with the Florida Civil Rights Act, the law hasn't changed, and that LGBT families aren't hurt by the passage of the law.
Governor Rick Scott signed the measure into law Thursday. It goes into effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A decade ago, a group of providers sued the state, charging Florida's Medicaid program shortchanged medical and dental care for kids. Proponents said Medicaid managed care was supposed to make it better. But 5 years into the new system, the legislature is poised to remove dental coverage for kids and roll it into a separate program.
All right, let's double check it. Just got to make sure everything is smooth. Feels good. All right, we'll take this out and give you a rest, okay? All right, now.
Dentists with the Florida Department of Health go to schools like Tallahassee's Sable Palm Elementary, where they've turned the teacher's break room into a mini dental clinic. They're performing free cleanings and dental sealants for kids in the second and sixth grade. That's when adult molars start coming in. It's a preventative service to try to ward off worse problems down the road. Many of the kids the program serves don't have regular dental visits, and this may be one of the few times they get treatments.
Okay. How do your teeth feel? Okay. All right. Do you need to take a deep breath and we'll try this side? Okay.
When Florida transitioned Medicaid managed care several years ago, it also folded in dental services. Providers said they could run health and dental together, and they even boosted some dental benefits for adults. It was a change in the way dental care had historically been provided in the state, says the Florida Dental Association's Joanne Hart. She says the old system was independent.
And it was shown that more providers participated, more children received services, and it had an 85-15% medical loss ratio, which is not currently in the MMA plan.
The medical loss ratio mandates how much insurers have to spend on actual services. That disappeared under Medicaid managed care. Republican Senator Alan Hayes of Umatilla is a retired dentist.
One of the prominent reason for dentists not treating Medicaid patients is the extremely low reimbursement rates and the onerous problems of getting the reimbursement. And so we need to make sure that the reimbursement is required to be as high as it can through the statute, and we need to be giving them adequate fees to see these patients.
Hayes was one of many lawmakers who voted for House Bill 819. It calls for a study of dental services in the state's Medicaid managed care system. If lawmakers take no action by July of 2017, the program would carve out dental by 2019 and revert it to the independent prepaid system that existed before managed care. The reversion would put medical loss ratios back in place. But according to a House analysis of the bill, adults could lose some of the additional dental benefits they received in the managed care system. The measure has won bipartisan and wide support in the legislature, and it's heading to Governor Rick Scott to approve or veto. That veto campaign is underway, led by the Florida Association of Health Plans. The group claims a move to carve out dental services before a study is evaluated is, quote, nonsensical. But should Scott approve the measure, a big issue remains: funding. Reimbursement rates for Medicaid dentists continue to fall far short of what providers are paid in other states that have been successful with a similar independent program. Senator Joe Negron was the architect of the state's managed care system, and he says he has plans to continue to address provider payments.
For Florida to get utilization rates that approach Texas and Connecticut, we're going to have to increase the rates.
Negron will be Senate president next year, but that does not guarantee he'll get the funding that he wants. And as with most issues in the legislature, nothing is promised. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Florida legislature has passed a number of claims bills, sending them on to the governor. But as Sasha Cordner reports, some lawmakers are upset one claims bill to compensate a surviving child of abuse did not survive the legislative process.
Miami Republican Senator Ana Terry Flores is carrying the Senate claims bill to further compensate Victor Barahona. She says he and his twin sister Nubia were abused by their former adoptive parents. Victor lived, she did not.
These children endured sexual abuse, mental abuse, physical abuse. They were forced to eat cockroaches. They were forced to eat feces. These are just unspeakable things. And finally, on the last day of her life, Nubia was found in the car of what was at the time her step-parent, and she was dead. And her brother, her twin brother, was still in the car. They found him covered in chemicals, and one could only imagine that they knew that his fate would be the same.
Flores says these kids were in the care of the state, which ignored the red flags.
And the department, time and time again, ignored phone calls from concerned neighbors that heard the screams of the children from the beatings, concerned teachers who repeated that for some years, for days, the children wouldn't go to school, that when they would go to school, they'd be picked up early, and when they would go to school, that they were hungry, that they would hoard their food, that they wouldn't be bathed for days.
The Department of Children and Families already paid $1.25 million to Victor for his and his sister's mistreatment. According to state law, a claims bill is needed to pay the rest of the $5 million settlement. Last month, Flores's bill unanimously passed its first two committees. Hialeah Republican Senator Renee Garcia chairs the Senate budget panel that looks at health issues, the bill's second stop. He says it's an important bill.
We've heard this, and it's long overdue.
But the bill never came up for a vote in its last committee. Flores says it stalled because the House never took up the measure.
The House never heard the bill at all, and I think that's what's caused the issue to not be come up for final vote in the Senate, because the House, you know, didn't even give this bill one hearing, which is incredibly disappointing.
Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel also called it disappointing. For the past several years, she's chaired the Senate committee that looks at children's issues. Sobel also was in charge of a new law overhauling DCF, spurred by the Barahona tragedy, as well as other child abuse-related deaths. Flores had a similar bill in 2014 for Victor, but it was recommended not to move forward with compensation because it could affect other cases against the former adoptive parents. At the time, Sobel expressed outrage, and she says it's still unfortunate lawmakers didn't do anything this year.
I'm very disappointed. Other claims bills came up. The surviving brother is in need of lots of services, lots of help, and we should have taken care of it. We should have taken care of this issue.
Still, Forrest says she will be back next year.
It's an issue that I'm going to continue to fight for, and, you know, when I'm back here next year, I'll fight for this issue, and I think that next year we'll have both a Senate president and a speaker who will be a lot more open and willing to deal with claims bills on average, in general, but this one is, you know, is the worst. It's the most horrifying of all, and it's incredibly disappointing that we couldn't get something done this year. And so we'll just have to come back and fight it again next year.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, born into a governor's mansion, Chelsea Clinton spent part of her formative years in the White House. In 2008, she went to college campuses to campaign for her mom's first presidential bid. Today, a more mature Chelsea Clinton was back in campaign surrogate mode, playing to a different target audience, as we hear from Jim Ash.
The smell of grits and bacon hangs heavy in Early's kitchen on South Monroe, and a who's who of Tallahassee's political and business elite lines the walls. Clinton is due in 20 minutes to address an event campaign aides are calling Tallahassee African Americans for Hillary. Luminaries are everywhere. Mayor Dot Inman Johnson, attorneys Ben Parks and Daryl Crump, 70s recording star George Clinton, a.k.a. P-Funk, City Commissioner Curtis Richardson is getting ready to warm up the crowd.
Well, we just want to hear her address the issues, of course, that are important to the African-American community.
What are they?
Well, jobs, education, fighting crime in the African-American communities, education, of course.
In a cramped corner, LaTana Banks sits quietly at a breakfast table with friends. The Florida A&M University program assistant wants to hear what a President Hillary Clinton would do about the economy.
Maybe also make it easy for single parents with daycares and stuff, more resources for them.
Clinton slips into a side door almost unnoticed before Reverend Greg James begins extolling her mother's virtues and her understanding of African-American issues.
And you know, the thing that I want to say to you today is that when we look at America, African Americans, we're still plagued with injustice. We're still plagued with mass incarceration. We're still plagued with inadequacies when it comes to school funding for schools.
After greeting a few locals by name, the former first daughter and NBC News special correspondent grabs a microphone and a stool and apologizes.
And I'm going to sit because I'm pregnant, so... Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you. I feel the same way. I'm feeling very blessed. But I also hear my doctor's voice in my head telling me to sit down.
The next president determines the fate of everything from gun control to abortion and voting rights, Clinton says, because he or she could pick as many as three Supreme Court justices. But, she says, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, her mother's chief rival, only talks about campaign finance reform. She does not refer to him by name.
She knows the court's important for so much more than campaign finance reform alone. And if you listen to my mother's opponent, he pretty much only talks about the Supreme Court through the lens of Citizens United.
Florida environmental and labor activists sent a letter to the Clinton campaign late Thursday calling on her to endorse a national ban on fracking, the controversial drilling method. Clinton says she hasn't discussed the letter with her mother.
My mom has spoken a lot about fracking, and she says very clearly that when local communities oppose it, she opposes it. She thinks that this very much should be a locally determined question.
Clinton works her way out of the tiny restaurant, posing for selfies and photos every few feet. Outside, Clinton, the recording star, says he's convinced Hillary will do the best job.
She's the only one qualified. I mean... You know, I like Bernie Sanders and all that, but she's been around the world. She's been here for a while. She's been doing it, and she knows what she's doing.
Chelsea Clinton's next stop is South Florida. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Next week, Capitol Report returns to its out-of-session schedule. We'll be broadcasting weekly on many of these Florida public radio stations. Please rejoin us then for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.